Something digging at your soul.
You're gonna have to get everyone's attention.
All right. Well, no, we're just getting our seating. All right. Well, as always, well, the past several weeks talking about different ways of seeing, and this week, if you haven't been stretched yet in this class. This next couple weeks, we'll try to open you up different ways of looking and thinking about things. So again, I had asked very early on in the class, kind of some definitions from you all, and put a few of those up there that might be highlighted. One of the definitions was, what isn't art, right? It's kind of a way of looking at things. We're gonna push that today and next week of, can anything be art? Should we be asking the question, is it art? So we'll see. Because, what about this? Guy named John Baldessari. This is actually the painting. it's pretty good size too. They're probably roughly the same scale. I mean, obviously wider as our banners, so they're very physical size to it. What is painting? Do you sense how all the parts of a good picture are involved with each other, not just placed side by side? Art is a creation for the eye and can only be hinted at with words. Maybe to add insult to injury, if you don't consider this artistic, the fact that he didn't actually paint this himself. He hired a sign painter to do it for him. So he did not actually touch the brush to the canvas for this. And a lot of the phrases that he used, he took from books on like how to make art or different things that art critics have said. So really kind of pushing the ideas of self-expression. The artist as a creative person, we'll go back to some of these things, a way of being, an opinion. So we'll get into him a little bit more. Let's back up a little bit with Jasper Johns, who we talked about a little bit last week. And so he started out making these flag paintings. In fact, he relays that he had a dream one night that he was painting a flag. So the next morning he got up and started getting the materials and started working on it. So, but for him, It was about just a way of composing the picture. It was like a ready-made design that he didn't have to think about, and so he could, as he says, work on other levels and different types of mark making and materials. This painting is actually built up. There's a lot of like newspaper articles built up underneath, and then he used a method called encaustic, which is melting down wax and mixing pigment with the wax. And so, the wax, as it dries pretty quickly, you have this really thick brush stroke and these drips that kind of stay in place. So there's a very tactile presence to these. But it kind of brings up notions, too, of the painting as an object, right? In one sense, this is not a painting of a flag. Like, if you were going to paint a picture or draw a picture of a flag, you would probably, draw the whole scene with the flagpole and the flag waving. It'd be like a picture or something. Like, you take a photograph of a flag. Here, though, I mean, there's no outside context. It's just the flag itself. And so, is it a flag as a painting? Is it a painting of a flag? Is a painting of an object, but it's kind of an object in and of itself, apart from what it's depicting. So it kind of just starts to raise these questions, and especially the art, all throughout the 20th century especially, but, you know, from the late 50s, early 60s on, you know, any sort of idea about art, you make a statement about art, and you can just start to pick away at all the words, and start questioning things and pushing these things, and that's kind of what we're going to start exploring. So we're over the next couple weeks, we're going to look at the idea of different materials for art, the process of making art, objectness, about whether an art has to be an object or can you get rid of the object, and the idea of space. And, of course, John Baldessari has something to say about that as well. Quality material, careful inspection, good workmanship, all combined in an effort to give you a perfect painting. One of my favorite, in terms of playing around with different materials, is an artist named Eva Hess. That's her in front of one of her last pieces. She unfortunately had a very short career. She had a brain tumor and died at a very young age, so her career only lasted 4 or 5 years. Only like 4 or 5 years. But made some phenomenal works. And this idea of playing around with what an art object is, I would like the work to be non-work. This means that it would find its way beyond my preconceptions. Interested in finding out through working on the piece some of the potential and not the preconceived. All right, so playing around with different materials, and in the process of working with these materials, the form of the work takes shape. And whether it's a form or, you know, playing with the idea of form, it's not like a preconceived shape that she's coming up with. Some of the materials she used: rope, paper mache, rubber, latex, fiberglass. New kind of industrial materials that are becoming available. And really, I mean, there's one sense where a lot of art stems off of new technology. There's a French classic artist in the 1700s. It's pronounced Ing. It's Ingres. Does these really amazing paintings and pencil drawings. And those were kind of new in art because the pencil, as a self-contained, you know, wood with the graphite that we're aware of, that was new technology back then. You know, artists before that just had like pieces of chalk or crayon or something that they would draw with, and the pencil being able to sharpen it to a fine point, that was a new thing. A lot of the landscapes that the Impressionists are known for is because of the new technology of having prepackaged paint in tubes that they can actually take with them out and paint landscapes, because before, artists would actually have to mix their own paints and buy the materials. So when you As technology changes and you have different materials available, that's going to play into the art. So here's a couple more of her pieces using some of the latex and fiberglass over, I think some of these are over like cheesecloth. These are a bear for art conservation people, because some of the materials are starting to break down and very hard to exhibit her works nowadays. They have to almost recreate some of them to some extent. But process of repeating the same thing over and over, the same shape, whether a cylinder, like a square, and yet because of the process and the materials, you know, these are handmade, so they're repeated, but they're not exactly the same, right? It's not like a industrial manufacturing process. So, fluorescent lighting was also a new material that could be tapped into. So an artist named Dan Flavin. And he said, I believe that art is shedding its vaunted mystery for a common sense of keenly realized decoration. Symbolizing is dwindling. Electric light is just another instrument. I have no desire to contrive fantasies mediumistically or sociologically over it or beyond it. Right? It's like they're electric lights. They are what they are. Don't read anything else into it. But the lamps will go out, as they should, no doubt. Somehow I believe that the changing standard lighting system should support my idea within it. So even the idea that these light pieces may not last forever was kind of somewhat of the idea behind his art. Of course, he's passed away now, and I'm sure all the collectors and museums are very concerned about whether or not they can keep these lights going and replace them with modern equivalents. But he basically had some standard set sizes, I think 1 feet, 2 feet, or two feet, 4 feet, 8 feet, or 6 feet, 8 feet. I think there was only like 7 colors he had available. So kind of a very limited option, and yet he comes up with some pretty startling effects. There's one of these at the Portland Art Museum, by the way. And so it, again, it kind of throws an idea about what is the art object, right? Because in one sense, the object isn't necessarily the light bulbs, right? The light cast on the walls is as much a part of the piece as the actual, you know, light fixture. So in one sense, the actual object of the art is not the object. It's just the means that creates the art piece, which is diffused light in various colors and combinations, and creates a whole different idea of where does the art begin or end and the room begins, kind of a thing. A couple other pieces of his. The one on the left, it's down in Marfa, Texas, and there's like these hallways that you can go down, and it's kind of a two-sided piece, so you can enter this way, and it's blue lights facing towards you and yellow going down the opposite end of the hallway, so you're in a blue space with some yellow there, or you can go back around and come in through the other side and be in a yellow-filled space with the blue in between, so... Yeah.
Is there a term for this? I mean, you have painting, you have sculpture, and then you got this mixed
media. Yeah. That's been a struggle. The question was, is there a term for this? You know, there's painting, there's sculpture. Sometimes you can call them mixed media. You know, yeah, that's one of the things that they're playing with, is trying to break down some of these definitions, because some of these, like these pieces are all on the wall. So is it kind of a painting? Sort of. I mean, they're three-dimensional in the sense that they come off just a couple inches from the wall, but it's not like a traditional sculpture that you would walk around, right? These are more sculptural, but I don't think any museum is going to let you like walk inside into the little corner part, corner of the room, and look inside the piece. So there's still very much a sense of painting, in the sense of, you know, you stand and just look at, you know, kind of a two-dimensional effect in front of you. The term installation starts being used for kind of works that take an entire space or a room. So both of these might be considered that, because they're designed. I mean, that hallway was, the walls are tilted to match the angle of the light, so that the space was created around the piece and as much a part of it as well. And so, yeah, and this one, you know, fills an entire room, so... but yeah, again, it's kind of like take a term for art and let's try to dismantle it, and let's question it, and let's push it. And it is a process of, in one sense, trying to get down to essences. You know, what is the essence? What does it mean for it to be a painting? What does sculpture mean? You know, and how do we kind of mine the meaning of those terms? And we're going to find out that the more you kind of dig into it, the more you can't pin them down, you know, which is part of what's going on. You know, at this time in the 60s, it is really, in philosophical terms, you have the beginning of what we call postmodernism, which really is an idea, to kind of boil it down to, how much can we really know? Because if you really try to delve down into the definitions of things, eventually you come to some arbitrary meaning of, you know, this is where we start, and everything is built off from that, logically. But it's you know, how can we really know truth if eventually we come down to just these words that, in one sense, have no meaning, because the meaning is dependent on context and relationship with other words, and that's always changing, and languages are different, and so a lot of that, those philosophical ideas start seeping into the art world as well. And so visually, artists are playing around with breaking down these definitions and posing questions and not necessarily providing answers. All right, so back to John Baldessari, you know, looking at materials. He started thinking of language as a material, right? So so he started off, well, he didn't start off this way, but arrived at this point of using words to kind of define or describe an experience. And I think it points to the limitations of language, but then also, you know, the limitations of our definitions of painting. I mean, in one sense, this is paint on a flat surface, so it's a painting, but it's not an image that he's making, per se. You know, some of these are kind of more philosophical, but a lot of these he takes out of, you know, like these manuals of how to be an artist. So either, you know, talking about composition, it is only when you have been painting for quite some time that you will begin to realize that your compositions seem to lack impact, that they are too ordinary. That is when you will start to break all the so-called rules of composition and think in terms of design. Then you can distort shapes, invent forms, and be on your way toward being a creative artist. He likes to put a lot of humor into these too, kind of a dry sense of humor. But tips for artists who want to sell: generally speaking, paintings with light colors sell more quickly than paintings with dark colors. Subjects that sell well: Madonna and Child, landscapes, flower paintings, still lifes, free of morbid props, dead birds, etc. Nudes, see, I got a nude in there for you today. Marine pictures, abstracts, and surrealism. Subject matter is important. It has been said that paintings with cows and hens in them collect dust, while the same paintings with bulls and roosters sell. You know, obviously ironic in the sense that these paintings are none of those things. You know? Well, a brush and paint were used to make the letters. However, he hired a sign painter to make these. So, again, is it art if the artist actually doesn't make it? Yes.
Yeah. Artists
you have artist studios,
and
yep.
The artists will come up with concepts, and then they'll have people chisel. I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
People doing their work for them.
And that's the thing, Melinda brings up a point. This there's a long history of artists not making their work, in a sense. Some of the earliest works that we have from Leonardo da Vinci are pieces that he made when he was a young artist working in the studio of a more experienced artist. And so the more experienced artist would often plan out the compositions, maybe paint some of the major figures, but then his studio assistants would paint some of the background details and landscapes and other minor figures. And so it's been kind of determined that, you know, this little cherub or angel in this painting by this other artist was actually painted by Leonardo da Vinci before he was Leonardo da Vinci. So there is kind of a history there. And you have some artists today that are very similar in that they employ, some of them, as many as like 40 studio assistants. I mean, they have a massive production. And they'll plan out the pieces and, you know, maybe do some of the work, but a lot of the work is actually, okay, you're doing this, I've got my painting crew that does this and my sculpture crew that does this, and so, yeah. Yeah, Kevin brought up the role of artificial intelligence. Yeah, that's a big hot topic in every endeavor, right? And there's already some AI created artworks that are happening. And so, yeah, what does that mean? You know, and that's really what art tries to explore, not in providing nice pat answers, but in kind of opening the questions. And I think that's really the power of art, the thing that really intrigues me about art. You know, as an artist, I sometimes think about, you know, what would happen if I lost an arm or a hand or, you know, lost an eye or something like that? You know, how would my art be affected? Having the idea that I could hire somebody to do the physical work brings me some peace on that, but it does raise the question. Well, and I was thinking, you know, when I posed the question, what is art? And you guys all gave me various definitions. Many of them were all true. But many of them, I think, opened up the realm of what art could be, perhaps even more than you might have realized when you said it. And so, you know, pieces like these can certainly fit in some of those definitions. But when you see these, do you immediately think of them, oh, this is art? It's a little bit more challenging to take in. So was the slide intentionally of a plank? Maybe not. So here's some other things that are going on. So sorry, some lengthy quotes from a couple books. The cognitive operations called thinking are not the privilege of mental processes above and beyond perception, but the essential ingredients of perception. Okay, so think about this. I'm referring to such operations as active exploration, selection, grasping of essentials, simplification, abstraction, analysis and synthesis, completion, correction, comparison, problem solving, as well as combining, separating, putting in context. There is no basic difference in this respect between what happens when a person looks at the world directly and when he sits with his eyes closed and thinks. Right? So when we're looking around us, how many of you have looked through your camera, taken a picture? This especially it can still happen now, but especially, right, back in the old days where you had film and you had to go and get it developed, right? And you get the pictures back from the developing place, and all of a sudden there's like some person in the background you didn't see, or someone's, you know, hand in the middle of the picture or something. It's like, I didn't see that there when I was looking through the camera, you know, to take the picture. But we do that all the time. We naturally select. We're very selective in what we see. And And even certain things like, you know, I can look at this chair from this angle and the same type of chair from this angle. The shape is slightly different, right? As it's turned, if you were just take a silhouette, they would be two completely different shapes. And yet I know they're essentially the same thing, right? Our brains and our eyes, I mean, you can't really separate the process of what our brain is interpreting what we're seeing, because the act of seeing is an interpretation to some extent. I'm seeing that these different shapes are actually the same thing, right? And just seen from different viewpoints. So when we think about visual art, what artists were starting to explore in some of these pieces and in some of their activities may be more in line with visualization rather than actually making something to see, but making something to make you think and to visualize what's going on. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are there practices that actually... That don't make them so categorized and so selective that you can ease the selection process so that it flows on its own?
Yeah.
That question makes sense.
Yeah. Are there practices that kind of break down some of these processes? Is that kind of what you're getting at,
maybe I'm just thinking about this through my own lens, which is a contemplative practice.
Yeah.
Which you choose not to stay and not to select,
mm-hmm.
but to just see how things arise.
Yeah. I think that's very much an artistic practice and one that isn't highlighted so much. But I talk about, especially with the abstract expressionists, you know, how much of the work in the studio is just the artist sitting and looking, you know. We see the final product. We don't see the long process of sometimes months of artists just staring at a piece and trying to, you know, kind of a contemplative practice of just looking, trying to get away from patterns of thinking and trying to actively look at it a different way. The artist Manet, one of the impressionists, he had a quote, something along the lines of, you know, when I go into the studio, and this is kind of metaphorically speaking, but it says, you know, first I ask the public to leave. And then I ask, you know, the art critic to leave. And then I ask myself to leave. And then I try to get into the work. So it's a matter of, some artists will maybe do more, you know, Zen-like or Buddha or any sort of contemplative practices, but sometimes just the way that you work in the studio is a contemplative practice in a sense. And the more, right, the more you see it in your work, then you start seeing things in life, in the world around you, and then that plays into your work, and then it's, you know, it becomes a dialogue between your intentions. You know, earlier I talked about Eva Hess trying to get beyond preconceived ideas, right? Maybe she has an idea that she starts out, but she keeps working through the process. And as you're working with the materials and the materials are responding and you're perceiving what's going on, that perception is a way of thinking. And you keep working at it until it goes in a direction that you didn't think would happen, right? That gets beyond what you were originally going for and becomes kind of a dialogue and an act of discovery rather than, I have an idea for a piece and I'm going to make it. And so that's I think that's very much what a lot of these these artists are going for. Did I accidentally switch slides? I did. Okay. So this is from a book called New Art in the 60s and 70s, Redefining Reality. It's a telling phrase there. The commonly held notion is that in conceptual works, which getting back to your idea of different terms for these artworks, whether painting or sculpture, conceptual art is kind of a term that's more about the idea rather than a particular medium like painting or sculpture. So that's a different term that's come up. The visual is, commonly held notion is that the visual is canceled out and physical realization made secondary. We see this really in, you know, John Baldessari's work. There's not really anything visual to look at. I mean, there's something to read, but it's, you know, it's kind of secondary. So this book is predicated on the idea that visual form and mental formulation are inextricably linked. Although it clearly overturned aesthetic convention, the art of the late 1960s and 70s, which has been called idea art or conceptual art, or has been described as dematerialized, never lost sight of its concern with the visual and the very nature of visualizing, even in the face of the invisible. Its success has been its revision of assumptions regarding what was once accepted as being visual, and the concomitant replacement of these presuppositions with other criteria for thinking and seeing. You know, thinking is often a visual process. Even if you don't visualize things, right, there could be certain processes that are visualized. That can be given somewhat of a form, or at least, you know, an idea of some sort of artwork that causes you to think about some of these things, ways that things are organized, for example. Yeah. Oh, hold on for a second until we get the mic.
This is all fascinating stuff, Michael. Thank you. I was thinking about my question about halos. And so way back, you know, a couple thousand years ago, people were, I think, there's something that, well, maybe it is there. I guess some people would say that you can see a halo around certain people.
An aura, but, yeah.
But there's a, you know, there's a visualization of something that isn't there, and how do you represent that?
Yeah, exactly. How do you visually represent holiness or righteousness, as opposed, you know, in this person is righteous and holy and this person is not. I mean, interacting with them, we might be able to tell, but how do we visualize that, right? Creating a halo or something like that. So there are these kind of invisible qualities of things that maybe we can visualize to some extent. So how do you make artwork that at least prompts you to think of those things, even if you can't actually picture them? And that's still just as much visual as creating something to look at. So, again, some of these ideas, right? Everything is purged from this painting but art. No ideas have entered this work. Except for the idea of what art is. And, of course, he makes pretty pictures, too. You know, pure beauty. He's done some other works. So here's something. How do you visualize sort of a process? Here the process is showing an artwork. Okay, artworks get shown in a lot of different venues. There's usually an original show that the artist has in a gallery, and then maybe a collector buys it and donates it to a museum, or there's group shows, and these paintings travel around, and that's how the word spreads. So he came up with this painting that is its own documentation. So, he started off with this first panel, June 19, 1968, idea conceived at 10:25 a.m., National City, California, by John Baldessari. July 30th, canvas built and prepared. July 31st, text prepared and edited. August 1st, painting commissioned. August 3rd, painting completed. October 6th, first showing, Molly Barnes Gallery, Los Angeles. Note, for each subsequent exhibition of this painting, add date and location below. For extra space, use an additional canvas. So this piece has grown over the years. So after its initial showing at the Molly Barnes Gallery, it went to Newport Harbor Art Museum in May through June of 1969. Again at the Newport Harbor Art Museum in October through November of 1974. Then the new museum in New York in 81. Several museums, and each time it gets shown, whoever's putting on the show has to hire a sign painter to add a new line of where it's being showed and when. And if you run out of room, then someone's got to build another canvas. And so you know, just the idea of an artwork tracking its own showing is intriguing to me. Yeah.
Okay, so another thing is, this is related in music. There's aleatoric music where the composer says, you know, play a high note as long and loud as you possibly can, or, you know, and so it's going to be formed differently on purpose. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you know, music always has to deal with this issue of time, right? Music, I mean, there's a time signature. It plays out over a length of time, whereas painting or sculpture is kind of an all at once, right? Everything's there. There's time involved. Maybe you see more as you're spending time with it. But there's kind of a time element. And I know that some of kind of the more progressive music movements have been trying to get, you know, like some sounds or chords to try to give kind of an all-at-once effect, right, to get rid of that element of time. And painting has tried to incorporate elements of time like this. So, so intriguing ideas of just opening your mind to, you know, what is possible, what's happening. Oh, yeah.
I'm constantly always searching for spiritual connections, mm-hmm. through all of this. And one of the ones that just seems, what it seems to me that artists are doing is trying to change our way of looking at things or open up, mm-hmm. our ideas of looking at things. And I really think that's very spiritual. You know, the idea that there's just a binary way of seeing things.
Yeah.
This or that changes and develops as you, mm-hmm. mature spiritually, and you see there are a lot of gray areas,
yeah, yeah.
in between. So I love that. I just, this is very helpful, Michael.
Thank well, thank you. I'm glad you bring that up too, because I forgot to mention, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about when, especially with this artist where he's hiring someone else to do the physical labor. You know, there's that passage where the disciples come up to Jesus and say, hey, these people are like casting out demons or healing people in your name. Should we stop them? And Jesus was like, no, it really doesn't matter who is doing it as long as it's being done, right? And so it brings up another notion. It's like, is it art because an artist made it? Isn't the fact of just selecting something to be art or coming up with the idea, is that where the genesis, the essence of the art is? I don't know.
I was going to mention, too, that last week, in the mornings on Sunday, there's a program on CBS called Sunday Morning, and they always have just fascinating stories, and this story was about a Native American artist whose name is Gene Quick to See.
Mm.
Smith, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Quick to See was given, that Native American name was given to her as a child because she saw things differently, mm-hmm. than other people. Well, she was having a big exhibit. It was a wonderful, wonderful story, but she's gotten so old that she can't manipulate the...
Yeah.
products that she
uses.
Yeah,
the materials and stuff. She does a lot of like some like fabric-based work too, right?
Yes,
where there's like sewing and stuff involved.
And she
has
her children and grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
She comes up with the idea and they produce it, and I love that. And the other thing that just was so impressive to me at the end of the interview, the girl said, you know, you never use the words me or I. You always say we and us.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, because every time I walk into a room, I'm bringing my tribe.
Yeah.
I loved that. That also felt very spiritual to me.
Yeah. Melinda has something here.
Well, it's funny, you know, when I'm thinking about these works of art, right?
works of art.
Yeah, and kind of listening to what Wendy was saying, it makes me think of, you know, after church last week, you and I went out to eat and having a conversation about art. And I was saying that to me, thinking about how does all this connect today, right? How does this connect to East County? How does this connect to all of this history, right? I mean, you're kind of giving us an art history class that normally would be a full year in, you know, a few weeks.
Yeah. It's been agonizing how much stuff.
Yeah.
I'm trying to decide what to cut out and leave out.
But, like, when I'm trying to fit, when, you know, and just this whole, like, okay, so where's the spiritual connection and how does this all fit? And really, you know, what I had kind of articulated and come up when we were chatting was, the thing that is so impressive to me or is so honoring to me is that when you think back, I mean, go all the way back to, you know, almost beginning of time, this way of thinking and this curiosity and this way of being was so selective in who had the time, the capability to think outside of facts and figures, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you were poor, if you were just your everyday man, you were, woman, human, you were consumed with, like, you get up, you did the things, you know,
to survive.
You were doing what you needed to do to survive, right? It was the wealthy, the well-to-do, the educate, you know, even that could have the advantage of education, right? That could, because obviously you had all this time on your hands that you could go learn about things, you know, versus other people are needing to tend the fields and whatever. And really, you have artists were the first ones to bring this question to the everyday man that anybody could just ponder and allow conversation to now we have a society that just we can ponder, right? It's not in this just who's in the room when it happens, right? These group of people that ponder. But now it's just for open because these group of people decided anybody can question. Anybody can say, like, what makes that thing a thing? Anybody can say, here, what's the landscape, right? And so just thinking about the course of it's complicated, human being, existence, world, and how the dialogue has grown throughout time to now we can sit in a class and think, how is this connected to our spiritual journey? How is that?
Yeah.
When, I don't know, 500 years ago, this wasn't a conversation people would be open to have.
Yeah.
And I think largely because artists started the dialogue for everyday humans.
Yeah.
And without artists, we wouldn't have the curiosity in which we are all sitting in right now.
I think it really opens it up as far as being inclusive. In one sense, you have this kind of exclusive high art, you know, society or whatever, but in one sense, in kind of raising the bar in terms of expanding the definition of what art is, you've actually kind of lowered the bar for entry, right? If you know, all kindergartners are artists, but, you know, only 10% of the third graders are artists, right? There's, you know, to some extent, there's a limited definition of what art is, right? And usually at that point, it's like, who can draw the best flower? That actually looks like a flower. But when you get beyond some of those ideas of talent and a particular aspect of doing art, and it becomes more about thinking and seeing, right? It kind of opens it up to everybody. And that's what I think really excites me about art of this time period is, I mean, you still have artists that can draw really well and do some super detailed paintings of things that look exactly like what they're trying to paint. And that is as much art as something like this, where you can hire somebody else to do the writing for you.
On all these ones that you've shown of this artist that are the textual ones, they've been the, you know, like, my background is in graphic design, so I'm looking at it from that, like, that's the art that I know, rather than the fine arts. And, like, that other one, it had all of the, like, broken words, and, like, on his one with all the rules, it broke all the rules of graphic design because of the way the words cut off.
Yeah.
But that, what you were just saying about the ability to, of anybody, you can bring other people in, looking at this one, I've been thinking about that, because he obviously gave direction, but he didn't give too specific of direction. Yeah. He left it to the people, because... Like San Francisco, on the date, it has a dash. And then on the Washington, D.C., it's an N dash. And then on the Walker, it's an M dash.
And the fonts are slightly different.
Like, like the spacing and the lettering, like, it's close, but it's not the same. So he wasn't telling them, reproduce this precisely like
precisely.
A machine.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, he was letting those people be part of his art in their own...
Which for me, has spiritual ramifications, right, of... Do we read the Bible and literally do everything it says? Or do we live our life and look at things the way the biblical authors live their life and look at things? Those are two very different, different activities. So kind of going over, speaking of like graphic design, you know, he also did some image things as well, but took... Take things that you're not supposed to do in art, right? Like, don't just stand in the middle of the picture right with a tree that looks like it's growing out of your head, you know? You want to space anything out. Or, you know, taking a picture of a parking lot, which is not a very artistic subject, but even then you have this tree right in the middle of, you know, kind of breaking up the composition or whatever. And then, you know, this... Writing an artist is not merely the slavish announcer of a series of facts, which in this case the camera has had to accept and mechanically record. And yet, aren't you the one holding the camera and directing what it manually records? Playing around again with the ideas of the thinking process really behind art, not just the physical process as well. Okay, I think we're running out of time. We'll have to... I got to do this one real quick. Another work by him. So he did a series of works where he had a friend of his just go around the studio, just random stuff, and he says, point to whatever you find is interesting, visually interesting. And so his friend would point, and then he would take a picture of what he's pointing at. So he came up with all these photographs. But then he went to, like, the flea market, and, you know, you have these little, you know, kind of like the Saturday market in Portland where you have all these artists down there. And so then he hired some of these artists, said, here, pick one of these photographs and make a painting of that photograph. So they're paintings painted by other people, and he, you know, put their names on the painting there of interesting visual things that were pointed out by someone else. So this whole idea of where does art come from, the source of art, the artist as, you know, some creative genius, in one sense he's really challenging that by taking himself out of the process almost as much as possible, right? And yet it's his idea that's coming up with this process of how he removes himself from the process. So it really kind of folds in on itself, but... So we'll explore some more things like this next week and get to some of these other pictures, especially this guy. Love this guy. I'll go through real quick. Oh, these are awesome. Okay, we'll get to those next week.
Individual that nobody would call an artist. closet.
Hey, good morning. Okay, so while it's on. Okay.
Shroud over eyes, the tables and the tide.